and it's running.
Alrighty, so let's jump right in with this passage in 1 Corinthians 13. And what I, basically how I want to outline my talk about these verses we just read are as follows. As followers of Jesus Christ, loving one another, what we're going to talk about in this session, loving one another, involves at least three things, okay? I want us to see the prominence of love in God's plan and how God intends us to understand it. I want us to see the preference of love in all our relationships and how God intends for us to incorporate it. And I want us to consider love's permanence and how focusing on that can help us put into perspective everything that's temporary. All right? I'll linger on that for just a second because I see some of you are writing. First of all, we're going to talk about the prominence of love. And we see this in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 1, 2, and 3. So the prominence of love. So let me give you just a little bit of background and then I'll flip the slide here for you. In these chapters leading up to 1 Corinthians chapter 13, this is a letter that Paul wrote to a church that he started. Now I told several of you that my missionary responsibility, in fact, if I don't know if any of you are from a Southern Baptist church here, but Southern Baptist churches participate through your giving in what we call the cooperative program, and that allows them to send missionaries all over the world. Well, I are one of those missionaries in New York City, and I'm supported by your tithes and offerings if you attend a Southern Baptist church. And so as a Southern Baptist missionary in the New York City metropolitan area, I help to start new churches. Even as I know Pastor Carter and his team were up there just last year, worked with one of our new church starts in Staten Island. And so Paul also was a church planter. And Paul started this church in the city of Corinth. And after he left the city of Corinth, he, as he did with many of the churches in the cities that he traveled to, he started churches and then he would write letters to them. And those letters became our New Testament, right? Most of us are aware of that. And so one of the things we realize when we read the book of 1 Corinthians is that in Paul's letter to the church at 1 Corinthians, he had some pretty challenging issues that he needed to address with that church. But he was also trying to teach them. And one of the things that he sought to teach them along about 1 Corinthians chapter 12 was about spiritual gifts. And he spent a lot of time talking about spiritual gifts. He said, I don't want you to be ignorant about spiritual gifts. I want you to understand that when we have the Holy Spirit of God living within us, that the Spirit of God empowers us in certain ways. And so he spends a lot of time talking about this. And spiritual gifts was a topic of great interest in the Corinthian church. Well, then Paul comes to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And it's almost like he changes the subject. And he waxes poetic. You know, because what we just read are, you know, words that are often quoted or recited in weddings. They were probably quoted or paraphrased in my wedding. My wife would know. I'm ashamed that I can't recall. But you've heard those verses before, probably. Even if you've never been in church, you've probably heard some of those verses before. Paul shifts gears from talking about spiritual gifts to talking about love. And in reality, he's just returning to the topic of love, as he does over and over and over again. And part of what I hope you see as we go through these lessons is that the thread of love is just, it's a scarlet thread that just weaves its way all the way through the scriptures, right? Everything about our relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ and about one another is intended to be undergirded by and held together in perfect love. And so Paul begins in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And one of the first things we see in these first three verses is that basically he says, okay, you heard all this wisdom that I had to teach you about spiritual gifts. Now we come to 1 Corinthians chapter 13 verses 1 through 3. And he basically says, all that's useless. All of that's useless without the spiritual fruit of love. He begins to drive home the importance of having love for one another. And let me just allude back to those verses. He says, if I speak in tongues of men and angels and have not love, I'm a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. You know, speaking in tongues, which is not common in a Southern Baptist church. It may be in yours, I don't know. But in the Corinthian church, there was a lot of clamor around, you know, should we speak in tongues? Should we not speak in tongues? Is it really a spiritual gift? Is it not a spiritual gift? And Paul says, you know, if you speak in the tongues of men and angels, but you don't have love, it's worse than a clanging gong, a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. The gift of prophecy, you know, was another gift that the church in Corinth was clamoring after. They believed that having the gift of prophecy was a great thing. And Paul said, you know, even if you do, but you don't have faith, and you don't have love, then it's nothing. If you have faith that can move mountains, and Paul definitely knew that Jesus often taught that if you have faith the grain of a mustard seed, then you can move mountains. Well, Paul said, you know, even if you have that faith of the grain of a mustard seed that could move a mountain, if you don't have the love of God living within you, then you basically have nothing. And so Paul is building on this foundation by saying, you know, all of these spiritual gifts, all of these fruits of Christian maturity that the church at Corinth were looking at, they were measuring the maturity of one another by these gifts. He said, they're nothing without spiritual fruit, without the fruit of love. He also goes on to say that to proclaim truth without love is immature. And you know what? We did this last night, and I'm going to try to keep us moving fast, but you see in each of these passages that, you know, we're mostly drawing upon 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 1, 2, and 3, but what I want to ask you guys to do is, can someone look up Ephesians chapter 4, verse 15? And then in the next point, can someone be ready with James chapter 2, verses 14 to 20? And then, you know what? We may not read those passages in James. I may summarize those. James chapter 2. But maybe someone be ready with Ephesians 4:15, and someone be ready with Galatians chapter 5, verses 22 and 23. Okay? So he goes on to say that to proclaim love, truth, without love is immature. And as we just saw, he says, if I have prophetic powers and can understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have faith so as to move mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. And so he basically says all of these things that we look to as signs of maturity, all of these things that we measure our spirituality by, or that the Corinthian church was measuring their spirituality by, are null and void without love. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 15. Someone have that? Read it nice and loud if you do.
From the NIV, instead, 4:15, right? Instead, speaking the truth in love, we will grow to become in every respect the mature body of Him who is the head, that is Christ.
Okay. Thank you. So basically, Paul, and I know we started in the middle of a sentence or a paragraph there, but if in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 15, what Paul was saying is that being able to speak the truth in a loving way, out of a spirit of love, is a sign of maturity. And so he's reemphasizing what he had already said here to the Corinthian church. He's reemphasizing that in his letter to the Ephesian church. He also says to practice faith without love is worse than unbelief. Now, again, you may not see all of that in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 2. He says it's nothing, right? To practice faith without love is nothing. To be able to move mountains is nothing. But in James chapter 2, verses 14 to 20, what James basically tells us is that faith without works is what? Dead. It's dead. And James is basically the one whose teaching aligns with Paul, who says that to be a person of faith, but to lack love is not to demonstrate that love. And so it's not really acting in belief upon God. Does someone have that? I know I said we weren't going to read that, but I feel like I'm kind of being sloppy with the articulation there. James chapter 2, verse 14 to 20. If you get it, just start reading.
New King James Version, Southern Baptist Convention. What does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can faith save him? If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, depart in peace, be warm and filled, but you do not give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? Thus also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. But someone will say, you have faith, and I have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I will give you my faith by my words. You believe that there is one God? You do well. Even the demons believe and tremble. But do you want to know, O foolish man, that faith without works?
Okay. So again, faith without love is worse than unbelief, because faith without the work of love in our lives is something that even demons are capable of. Faith without the work of love in our lives doesn't demonstrate that we truly practice what we say we believe. And this is really what we see in James chapter 2, verses 1 through 10 either. It's easier to be religious than it is loving, because in James chapter 2, in those first 10 verses, what James cautions the church about is, he said, if you welcome someone into your sanctuary, into your church, who is well-dressed and who has means, but you shun the person who doesn't have means, and you don't act lovingly towards that person, then you're like an infidel. And so it's easier for us to be religious than loving, and it's important for us to see that, because really we call that hypocrisy. And again, to practice that kind of religiosity without love is worse than unbelief, and that's basically what hypocrisy and heresy means. We make a heresy of the truth of God when we don't act lovingly towards our brother and sister. So the first and the greatest fruit of a spirit-filled life, many of us could probably quote these verses, Galatians 5, verses 22 and 23. Does someone have those? Can you read those?
But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such things there is no law.
Okay. The first and the greatest fruit, Paul says, of a spirit-filled life is love. And so you really can't escape this thing of love. I mean, if you've got an issue with this thing of love, then you've got a heart issue that's got to be dealt with. The prominence of love throughout the New Testament, throughout the Scriptures, it's inescapable for all of us. And if we're to really practice our faith, and if we're to be a people who, by our faith, by our religion, point people to God, then love has got to be at the core of who we are. And it's got to be demonstrated in the fruit of our lives. Let's talk about the preference of love. And I want to camp out on this one just a little bit. Okay, I don't think it's hard to emphasize the prominence of love. But let's talk about the preference of love, because I think this is where we get a little bit more into application. The great theologian John Mayer sings, love ain't a thing, love is a verb. Right? Love ain't a thing, love is a verb. There are probably a lot more eloquent people that I who can't sing as well, but probably a lot more eloquent people that I could have quoted who emphasize the same thing. But you know, if love ain't a thing, if love is a verb, have you ever wondered, why do we look for love instead of acting in love? I think, I kind of jokingly alluded to Maslow's hierarchy of basic human needs last night. But you know, love is something we all need, and we all seek it out. But interestingly enough, we don't. It seems fascinating to me that we don't seek it out by first offering it, by acting in love. We want to be loved before we return love. But is that the Christ-like way? What did Jesus say? What did Paul say in Romans chapter 5, verse 8? He loved us because we first, we love him because he first loved us. And so why do we look for love instead of acting in love first? And so love, both indeed and indeed, or truly, is the ultimate measuring stick of Christ's likeness. And we see this in John chapter 13, verses 34 and 35 that we read last night. And this is really, again, if you were to pick one verse, it's kind of at the core of this lesson on loving one another, this would be a new command I give you: love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. And you see, again, if anything, the Apostle Paul just undergirds everything we've just said about the prominence of love. And that is, he emphasizes that the primary and ultimate measuring stick of our Christ-likeness, of our followship of our discipleship is that we love one another. I don't know if you realize, but so many of us in the United States today would identify ourselves as a Christian nation. We would refer to ourselves as Christians because we live in a quote-unquote Christian nation. But the word Christian is only used maybe two or three times in all of Scripture in the New Testament. And even though we largely define ourselves, identify ourselves in that way today, Jesus' choice designation for those who were believers was disciple. And disciple means follower. And so what we gather from John's teaching in John chapter 13 is that if we're one of those followers of Jesus that he points to 200 times in the scripture, then those that he is referring to are those who have the capacity and who recognize the responsibility of acting lovingly towards one another. All right? So, again, this is all well and good, right? Got it. Calligraphy it. Put it on the wall. I'm good, right? But how do we work that into our hearts and out through our hands? To the world? How do we get that from our heads to our hearts to our hands? And that really has a lot to do, I think, with the preference of love, showing people the preference of love. I think if we thought about it, we'd realize that the lack of love lies behind so many forms of disobedience. If you were to take those verses that we just read in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and nuance them just a little bit and put the words lack of instead of love, instead of saying love is patient and kind, we could easily say that the inverse is true. Lack of love is impatient and unkind. Ever been that, by the way? Impatient or unkind? Lack of love envies and is boastful. Lack of love is arrogant and rude. I've never, have you? It insists on its own way. It is irritable and resentful. It celebrates wrongdoing and it celebrates untruth. I don't know about you, but to read it that way is very convicting to me. If love is the ultimate measuring stick of fellowship, of discipleship, according to Jesus, loving one another, then to demonstrate lack of love is the inverse of that. It demonstrates anything but a heart that is right with God, a heart that longs to follow God, a heart that longs to reflect God in our lives. And so I have to ask myself, do any of these attitudes ever characterize my relationships with others? And if so, what does that say about the condition of my heart? If so, what does that tell me about last night when we talked in our discussion groups, we talked about it's the Holy Spirit of God living within us that has to really help us act lovingly, especially when we don't feel loving, right, towards others. And so when we experience these attitudes and in our relationships with others, we have to ask ourselves, okay, so why is the Spirit of God not winning the day in my life? You know, why is it that I'm irritable or impatient or unkind? Why is it that I envy? You know, I don't know about you, but and I think it's taken me a long time in life to really acknowledge and admit this, but I think I grew up in a family that seemed to always envy what others had and to suspect the motives of those who had more or experienced success. I don't know if that's as common as I think it probably is. I do suspect that that's pretty common, that there's something within us that wants to suspect others, if they have more, or if they're more blessed, or if they experience more success, then we want to question their motives, we want to question their heart. That's envy, folks. And it's an ugly, ugly thing, and I recognize it in myself sometimes, and I try to ask the Spirit of God, would you rebuke that in me? This thing that always has to look at the success of others, that can't be glad and rejoice in other people's successes, but that has to be jealous of those, right? I think we all struggle with that a little bit. So I think we have to ask ourselves, do any of these attitudes ever characterize your relationships with others? And if so, what then? So in Romans chapter 13, verses 8 and 9, and recognize the Apostle Paul is the author of so many of these letters, Paul says that we should not owe anyone anything except love. We should not owe debts except to love. And he says, pay all your debts. This is the New Living Translation, I think. Pay all your debts except the debt of love for others. You can never finish paying that. If you love your neighbor, you will fulfill all the requirements of God's law. That's a big statement, isn't it? Now, wait a minute. You know, you have to stop here. If you've been tracking with me so far, read that sentence again. Again, this is a New Living Translation, so it's another translation, but it is a translation. It says you can never stop paying the debt of love that you owe to another. Now get this. He says, if you love your neighbor, you will fulfill all the requirements of God's law. Now, well, wait a minute. That's not what we read last night, was it? What's the great commandment? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, right? Jesus answered that when the question was asked to him. And he did give that second part, love your neighbor as yourself. But now we see Paul saying here, he doesn't even go to that part about loving God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength. Why do you think that is? He says, if you love your neighbor, then you fulfill all the requirements of God's law. You think maybe that a part of what he's saying is it's that hard to do? That you can't do that apart from the power and love of God at work within you? You think maybe that he's implying that the power to love others with this godly type of love that he's talking about, that he's implying that it can only come from the Spirit of God living within us, which is transforming us by a love for God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. You know, in other words, we can't have one without the other. So if you love your neighbor, he says, you will fulfill all the requirements of God's law. For the commandment against adultery and murder and stealing and coveting, what's he referring to there? Not the great commandment. He was just referring to the great commandment in the first part, right? But now he's referring to what commandments? The Ten Commandments, right? And so he's really hammering this home. First he says, fulfill the great commandment and you'll fulfill the requirements of God's law. Then he says, the Ten Commandments, the law of Moses against adultery and murder and stealing and coveting. And he says, just in case he misses something, he says, and any other commandment you want to lump in there are all summed up in this one commandment. Love your neighbor as yourself. Wow. That's pretty big, right? Again, I think we have to really process that. We have to really think about, okay, so how is it that in loving my neighbor as myself, in loving those that I live with, that I have to do life with, how is it that in loving those people that I really demonstrate that I love God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength? Let's look, for example, at the Ten Commandments. So lack of disobedience lack of love lies behind disobedience to all these commands. So basically the first four commands talk about there being one God, that we shouldn't bow down to any other God or graven image, about honoring God by not taking his name in vain, about honoring God by observing a Sabbath. And so commandments 1 through 4 talk about honoring and worshiping God alone. Can lack of love for others, do you think, cause us to fall into disobedience for these commands? What happens when we lack love for other people? We put ourselves first, don't we? I don't know how far we'll get to go down this road, but when we begin to put ourselves first in our lives, essentially what we're doing is we're making ourselves an idol. We're putting ourselves before God. We're, as some have said, asserting our ego, edging God out of our lives. And so we begin when we lack love for our neighbor and for those in our lives, we fall prey to disobedience that edges God out of our lives. If you look at the commandments 5, 6, 7, and so forth, in the fifth commandment, what happens when we lack love or we act lacking in love, maybe resentfully or irritably towards our parents, and we don't honor our father and mother? What have we done? We've disobeyed God's commands, right? By simply lacking love, by simply failing to demonstrate love, we've violated the law of God. And we've shown that in that moment, we're not followers of Christ. What about do not murder? Now, Jesus said, You've not shed anyone's blood, that's great. Have you ever hated someone? Have you ever, then you've committed murder in your heart towards someone. Maybe you've never committed adultery, I hope you never do, or fornication, but if you, Jesus says, I think it's in Matthew chapter 5, that if we commit adultery with someone in our minds, right? That's the same thing. We've violated that person in our minds. We've acted in a way that's not loving towards that person in our minds, and we've violated the law of God. So, do you envy what someone else has? Then it's as good as having stolen from them. Do you celebrate when others have a downfall? You know, do you say, I knew that that couldn't have been genuine. They were just experiencing too much success. Or when you slander someone, foster some untruth about someone, that's acting unlovingly and it's violating the law of God. Do you covet what someone else has? Then we act in ways that are not loving towards someone and we violate the law of God. The great commandment again says, love God and love your neighbor as yourself. Paul tells us, if you don't pay your debt of love towards someone, if you ever stop paying your debt of love towards someone, then you violated both. You violated the great commandment and you violated the law of God, the law of Moses, the Ten Commandments. Let's continue on the preference of love in verses 4 through 6 of that passage we read. How can acting in love help us not to sin against God or others? Right? Hopefully all of us, you know, the law of God is a beautiful, awful thing. Okay? You guys are just saying, boy, you just blasphemed. How about the law of God being an awful thing, right? Jesus essentially says that. He says the law of God reveals our sin. It's a terrible thing. It reveals our sin. It reveals the condition of our hearts. But it's a beautiful thing in that it contains the gospel of Jesus Christ towards us. It shows us a better way, which is what Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. In fact, the last verse of 1 Corinthians chapter 12 says, and now I'll show you a better way. Love is patient and kind. It doesn't envy. It doesn't boast. The gospel is a better way. Because it shows us not just how the law of God convicts our heart, but it shows us how the Spirit of God and the gospel of grace transforms our hearts and gives us the ability to act lovingly towards our neighbors. So how can acting in love help us not to sin against God and others? This is why last night we went to the one another's. And some of the examples that we read about were forgiving one another. Jesus says, when someone came up to him and they said, Master, how many times must I forgive my neighbor if he sins against me? The guy's a real jerk. You know, maybe I forgave him a couple of times, but he just keeps violating me. He just keeps sinning against me. He says, how long do I have to put up with this? Seven times? What did Jesus say? 70 times seven. And he didn't mean 490 times either, did he? He didn't mean, you know, keep a tally. Jesus meant keep forgiving him. Seven was a perfect number. Keep forgiving him. Forgiveness demonstrates that we understand the law of God. It demonstrates that we understand the gospel of grace, that we act lovingly towards one another, even when we don't feel loving towards another, because we know that this is evidence of the Spirit of God living within our lives, and we also know that it's being loyal. That for us to act lovingly towards another when they don't deserve it is us acting in love. It's us paying our debt to God and paying our debt to them. We pay our debt of love to God when we act lovingly towards someone who doesn't deserve it. Right? Because we don't deserve God's love. And so we also talk about serving one another. And we're going to talk about that a lot more here tomorrow. So I don't want to go too much into that. Actually, we're going to talk about that this afternoon. Submitting to one another. And we're also going to talk about that some more. Encouraging one another. You know, can you encourage someone without loving them? You probably can. You can probably encourage someone without loving them, but you have to care for them a little bit if you're going to encourage them. And so, how can acting in love help us not to sin against God or sin against others? Care enough to encourage someone, to help someone succeed. and not to be jealous of their success. You know, again, and you've all heard this, to encourage someone means to grieve with them in their sorrows. And the old proverb says, if you grieve with someone in their sorrows, you half it, right? You carry half of it. But if you celebrate someone with someone in their victories, what do? You compound it. You double it, right? I told you last week that we celebrated our 140th, and we told people, you know, don't bring any money or don't bring any gifts or anything. And we actually spent, even though it was a fairly modest party, we invited a lot of people, and we spent a lot of money we didn't have, mostly just because it compounded our joy to celebrate God's goodness by having those people there, and God provided, you know. But that was an encouragement to us to celebrate with those that we love God's goodness in our lives. So that's what it means to encourage one another. And in so doing, we fulfill the law of God. The preference of love, continuing. I want us to consider these thoughts. So love is a preference. It's a preference to not sin against another person. You know, we can actually, and this is somewhat redundant here, let me just go ahead and read them. Love is a preference. It's a preference not to sin against someone. In other words, we have a choice, right? We don't have to react in the way that our fleshly human nature wants to react in a moment. Love in a believer always grieves over wrongdoing, and it always celebrates goodness. You know, it's not the other way around. Lack of love in a believer or an unbeliever tends to celebrate wrongdoing or injustice, and to grieve over goodness or the success of another. Love is a choice to respond as God would respond to others, others' fortune or misfortune. Again, this is addressing the whole issue of envy. Because love is a choice, I'm always able to choose my response. Just some things to consider. And then before we go to point number three, one more thought. So if we think about the preference of love and what it means to act lovingly rather than as our human nature would have us to react in our relationships towards our neighbors, then hopefully what it leads us to do is to be slow to suspect. In other words, slow to suspect wrong motives or a wrong heart or ill-gotten gain or success. So slow to suspect, quick to trust, which means we're going to get taken advantage of sometimes, right? And we are, you know, counseled in Scripture also to be wise. But we're told to be quick to trust. You know, is it easy for you to give someone the benefit of the doubt, or are you just always really struggling not to doubt someone's motives? Slow to condemn, quick to justify. You know, quicker to defend someone than to attack someone. Those are both legal terms, to condemn or to justify. Slow to offend, quick to defend. Slow to reprimand, quick to forbear. So that really deals with the issue of patience, among other things. Slow to belittle, quick to appreciate. Again, these are challenging things, right? Because our egos want to edge God out. Our egos want to say, what about me? Slow to provoke, quick to appease. Slow to hinder, quick to help. Slow to resent, quick to forgive. And then let's talk about the permanence of love. This will be relatively short and we'll be finished. But the permanence of love. You can't miss this in these verses that we just read in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, beginning with verse 8. But in 1 Peter chapter 4, we see another New Testament writer who says, above all, keep loving one another earnestly, since love covers over a multitude of sins. You know, I love it that God the Father, that the Spirit of God, that Jesus Christ recognizes that all of our hearts, as Isaiah says, are deceitful and desperately wicked. You know, our cheating hearts will lie to us. And our cheating hearts will justify our sinful attitudes and behaviors. But love, Peter says, covers over a multitude of sins. In the passage that we just read, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, English Standard Version, what we see is that everything else that seems of value now in this world will cease except love, because love never ends. Everything that you'll gain in this world, you'll surrender someday. But the love that you gain in this life will endure with you. There'll be a heavenly reward attached to it. And by the way, if I'm not going to presume that just because that we're all church going people here, or that even if we are, that our hearts are fully redeemed, that we have to realize that lose my train of thought there, that we have to realize that it's got to be the Spirit of God working within us, which transforms our hearts. And if you don't begin a relationship with God in this life, then there will be no relationship with God in the life to come. And so it's so important that we steward this life that we've been given. And so when the opportunity is held out to you to begin a relationship with Jesus Christ in this life, you have to strongly consider that. Because all of those things you may hope that await you in the life to come will not if you don't begin a relationship with God in this life. The permanence of love. Love is the link that God gives us with His eternal self. As He says in verses 9 through 12, "For we know in part and we prophesy in part." Right? We can't fully know everything in this life. "But when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away." In other words, there is going to be a time when things are perfectly revealed. And that's going to be when we stand before God, who knows all. "When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child." I'd like to know when we stop being children, because I know sometimes we all act a little bit like children. But the Scriptures tell us that when I mature in God's love, when I become a man or a woman, mature in the faith, we give up childish ways. In other words, we cease to act out of selfishness, and instead we act out of love for God and for one another. Verse 12, "For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we will see face to face." And so again and again, we're pointed into the future, into eternity. "Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known." The permanence of love. I love this statement. Love looks through a telescope. Selfishness looks through a microscope. Think about that. This verse, again, everything that we just read, it's like a telescope into eternity. God's saying, you know, it's okay that you don't understand everything. That you can put your hope and your faith and your trust in me, because I do. That in me, if you'll continue to mature in this life, that you'll receive a heavenly reward, and face to face you'll understand. But love looks through this telescope of God's promise. Selfishness looks through a microscope, right? Selfishness makes a mountain out of a molehill. I don't get my way. What do? I grow resentful and bitter, and unloving and unkind and irritable, and arrogant and rude. Again, love is patient and kind. Love doesn't envy or boast. Love doesn't, again, magnify those things that are minuscule in our lives and make them more important than they really are. That's selfishness that does those things, that causes us to act arrogantly and rudely, to insist on our own way, to be irritable and resentful when we don't get our own way, right? The permanence of love. Love doesn't keep a record of the failure of others. Instead, love bears all things. Love believes all things. Love hopes all things. Love endures all things. Again, it's not focusing upon this minuscule moment when you have conflict with a brother or sister. It's looking at the big picture and saying, you know what? It really doesn't matter. I still love you. And we'll get through this, and we'll be better because of it. And this is why last night we pointed to some of these one another's. Bear one another's burdens. Love bears all things, so bear one another's burdens. Love believes all things. Be devoted to one another. Believe the best about one another. Give one another the benefit of the doubt. That's what it means to act lovingly towards another. Love hopes all things. Accept one another. accept one another. Remember, we said that all of us long for acceptance. Have you ever wondered why maybe someone behaves towards you in a certain insecure way? By the way, we're all insecure. That's the seed of sin in our hearts. That's our selfish nature that causes us to act with insecurity. We're all grasping and clawing for our own. I heard a minister of missions in a great big church say one time, if you don't toot your own horn, who will? And I thought, wow. Wow. We're all insecure. We all long for the praise of men, and what a ridiculous thing that is. Love hopes all things. It accepts others. It gives us the acceptance. You know, what does it hurt us to give someone the acceptance that someone so desperately craves and needs? You know, we all long for acceptance. Give a little. Love endures all things. It bears with one another. In conclusion, I like this quote by C.S. Lewis. He says, "To love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will certainly be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give your heart to no one, not even to an animal. Wrap it carefully around with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid entanglements. Lock it up safe in a casket or a coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe and dark and motionless and airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. The only place outside of heaven where you can be perfectly safe from all dangers of love is hell." Love is going to hurt. Love is going to wound us. To love is going to make us vulnerable. I want us to go into our discussion time now and turn it over to you guys to divide us into our groups or to make sure that everyone knows which group they're in. And I'm going to go with a different group than I did yesterday. So.